It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, yesterday's Cyber Monday saw record sales, and Amazon now is announcing you may soon receive your packages by drone in the near future. We'll talk about how the world of retail and shopping is changing.
First, we're launching a new series on Central Time called Teach Me What You Know.
Yeah, each week we're going to learn from experts in different areas on a wide range of topics, from how to ace a job interview to how to ice fish or maybe even ballroom dance, but not while ice fishing.
This week, we are going to learn how to start a business. Many of us have dreamed of quitting our day job and venturing out to become our own boss, whether or not it's for a local restaurant or to become an inventor.
Our next guest has plenty of advice to share. Matt Yonkel is the founder of Laminar Technologies. He's been awarded 13 U.S. and international patents. He's also a graduate of UW-Madison, and he mentors local entrepreneurs through Merlin. That's the Madison Entrepreneur Resource Learning and Innovation Network. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Let's jump right in. What is the most important part of starting your own business?
Having a great idea and having a lot of passion for that idea. So I guess it's two things, but you need to have the passion and the idea.
So the passion, let's talk about that. Obviously, if you're starting a business, you've got to really sell it to yourself, first of all, I guess.
Yeah, you have to really believe in it. It's going to be something. You're going to spend more time working on your company than you're going to spend with family, with friends. It's going to be something you're really going to be living after you launch. So it's got to be something that you really, really like to do.
So those of us with short attention spans who can't commit to something like that, probably maybe starting a business isn't for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like to look at it. The passion is something that you're getting pulled into doing, as opposed to a duty. A duty is something you sort of get kicked out and you kind of do it because you have to. A passion is something you're doing it. You can't get your mind off of it. If you've got that kind of thing happening, then starting your own company around that idea is right for you.
So that's the passion. And you mentioned the other key is the idea. How do you do that?
Most of my ideas come from my own personal problems or things that I notice. I keep a bug list, a list of things that bother me. My current business is Murfie.com, M-U-R-F-I-E.com, and we've got a marketplace for selling, trading, buying music online. And that came about because I'd moved back to Madison after living abroad. I had all sorts of music CDs. I didn't have a CD player to play them on. And so I had this problem. And I said, well, if it's not just me that has this problem, probably lots of other people. And turns out there are 15 billion CDs in the U.S. and that are just sort of sitting on shelves and bookcases. And we're trying to provide a solution to that problem.
So you're just kind of an observational comic in a way, finding those little nuisances that we usually just take without thinking about it and then taking the next step and trying to solve those.
Exactly right. So keep a bug list. Things that bug you probably bug a lot of other people. I've been keeping one since I've been 18 years old. It's gone on 10 pages, and it's a ton of fun. You can look back 10 years to 20 years down the road and kind of see what was bugging you long ago, and maybe a $1 billion business started out of that idea, or maybe it was just a horrible idea and you're glad you didn't pursue it. But have that list and keep the list. Write it down.
I'd love to dig deeper into the bug list, but probably we should proceed now from the idea. You've got your idea. You take that thing from your bug list that you think is a winner. What's the next step?
Well, the next step really kind of depends on what kind of product or idea that you have. You know, if it's a product, if it's something you're going to create, you're going to build, generally the next best step is to prototype. Try to create some sort of working version. Try to build what you envision, just to get like the basics out, and then we can start to show it to people. Get some feedback about that product or idea.
Well, that probably sometimes tells you a thing that looked easy initially is actually going to be a lot more work to make than you thought, or maybe vice versa.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing is it gives you something to show other people. And that type of feedback, taking your product, your idea out to the world and getting that feedback from potential customers, from investors, if you're going to do that, that's super, super important. A lot of people with great ideas, they're great ideas and they harbor them, they keep them really close. They don't want to run the risk of someone stealing their idea, so they never do anything with it. I think it's really important that you get that idea and get it out there and get it in front of real potential customers as soon as possible.
Well, yeah, how do you do that? How do you approach people, whether you're talking about customers or other businesses, whatever it might be?
It's pretty easy. I mean, you figure out who are likely customers for your product. In the case of a company I started called Laminar Technologies, we created a product called TurboTap that poured draft beer faster. So easy there. Customers are sports stadiums. So we networked like crazy to get in front of people that were running sports stadiums and ended up selling and placing a lot of TurboTaps that way. With Murphy, it's consumers that love music, that love CDs, that have large music collections. And you know that's a business to consumer. So it's going after consumers. And there are lots of people just in Madison that have large CD collections. So it's really easy to go and knock on doors and talk to friends and family in terms of what they think of your idea.
All right. You've got your prototype now. You know that people are interested in it. Where do you go next?
Well, you've got your prototype. You've got some folks interested, and now it's I guess again it depends on what kind of business it is. I think you need to also prove that people are willing to spend money on your product. And you know, oftentimes, again, this involves when you're showing your product around and asking questions of friends and family of potential customers, like really drilling down to figure out, is this something that customers will really purchase? So trying to get that first order, that first set of orders, figuring out who your paying customers are, figuring out price points for your product. I mean, there's an art. It's an art that's a whole segment upon itself, is figuring out how to price a new product. But going out and figuring out who is going to actually pay money for your new product and a new concept.
Speaking of money, I think a common challenge for people is getting the money to start. What's out there? How do you get that upfront investment?
Sure. If it's your first time starting a company, your most likely source of funding is going to be friends and family. And that's because you have to find people that believe in you. You can have a great idea, but first and foremost, people are going to be investing in you, the entrepreneur, to make that idea happen. And that means you need to be asking, if you're going to be fundraising, outside raising, outside capital, it's got to be from people that know you, that trust you, that know you as a person. Because your idea might change once you put it in front of customers, that you can pivot, you can end up with all sorts of different ideas, but you are going to be the one that takes that forward. So those are the first people that you need to go and ask if you're going to be raising funds.
Well, a lot of times the you in the business is a plural you. A lot of people start off with partners. What should you look for in a good business partner?
I think it's somebody that you want to have enough interest in common that you don't drive each other crazy, but you need to also be very complementary in terms of your skill set. Mm. So in the case of TurboTap, I tend to be more of the introvert, the engineer that likes to tinker and sort of build things, and I needed to have somebody that could go out and sell.
You need a P.T. Barnum.
So yeah, exactly. So my business partner there was like the Uber sales guy. He was able to go out. He was just this very, you know, very gregarious, outgoing person. In the case of Murphy, I had some initial thoughts. Again, I'm still more of an engineer. I needed somebody who could operate business, manage an engineering team better than I could. And so my co-founder there, Preston Austin, is just doing a terrific job on the operation side of the business.
Even with good ideas, with the upfront money, businesses struggle at the beginning. If your business isn't going well early on, how do you know when to draw the line between sticking it out and plowing through or calling it quits, knowing when to hold them or when to fold them, I guess, as the song says?
That is the single toughest question to answer, I think. And that's a really, really hard question, because if you have passion for something, I think first off, if you're having trouble initially, I mean, having a co-founder, having a couple of co-founders on your team, Murphy, we have two others. It's first convincing a couple other people to join you, I think, is one of those hurdles. If you can convince a couple other people to join your cause and that share your passion, that's hurdle number one. And then hurdle number two is finding customers and finding passionate customers to get started. If you're getting stuck getting other people to sort of join up with you, I think that's sort of warning sign number one. And then warning sign number two is if you've kind of done all you could, but you're just not getting any orders, not having any customers come in the door, that's a second warning sign.
That's got to be heartbreaking, though, to pull the trigger on this thing that hopefully you were passionate about to begin with.
Usually the ideas have some merit in some way. So we talk about pivots, like changing something fundamental, but keeping some of the idea intact. And so oftentimes businesses that fail out of the gates can make a pivot, can change from selling to consumers to selling to other businesses, something like that, that will then turn and make them successful.
Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about yesterday's record Cyber Monday sales. If somebody were asking you, hey, should I open up a brick and mortar store? Would you say, no, don't do it? It's all internet now? Or is there still room for having a building?
I think there's definitely room for local commerce, for brick and mortar. My passion these days is online, moving music collections online with Murphy. So again, I think it depends on your passion, but physical goods have to come from somewhere, have to go somewhere. So I think there's opportunities all over the place.
All right, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Rob.
That's Matt Yonkel. He's founder of Laminar Technologies, UW-Madison graduate. His latest venture is the music site Murphy.com. And this is our first installment of Teach Me What You Know. Next week at this time, we'll learn from a longtime friend of the Dalai Lama about how to meditate. We just wrapped up the busiest shopping weekend of the year. From the newly coined Gray Thursday to Cyber Monday, retailers did everything in their power to get you to buy their stuff. Seemed to work, maybe not as well as expected in the stores, with sales figures slightly down from previous years. But Cyber Monday set a new single-day record, with shoppers dropping over $2.25 billion on internet purchases.
We also heard news this week that Amazon wants to start offering 30-minute deliveries by drone. And while this could take a while to become a reality, it's pretty clear that retail, as we know it, will never be quite the same.
Joining us to make sense of the changing face of retail is John Talbot, Associate Director of the Center for Education and Research in Retailing at Indiana University. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thank you. How's the weather up there? Cold?
Not too cold. Kind of rainy, snowy in the northern part of the state, though. So it's a little messy. A little messy for the drive home.
Well, we have nice weather down here in Bloomington.
All right. Enjoy it while you can.
Yeah.
Well, we in the media make a big ruckus about this weekend we just got out of, from Thursday through Monday. Is it really that important an economic indicator for the nation as a whole and retail in particular?
For retail in particular, certainly, and I think for the broader indicator of how the U.S. economy is doing, I also think that it is important for that. I don't know if you've noticed, but I just was reading that the stock market is down, I think, about a four-day down run for the first time since September, and I'm sure that's attributable to what's being seen in terms of the performance of retail out there right now. Because it's driven a lot by retail stocks. I noticed Amazon was down almost 2% today.
So I heard we mentioned just now that Cyber Monday set some record sales numbers this year, but is this one of those cases where, yeah, we did better than last year, but we didn't hit the expectations that we had coming into this year?
I think it was a good day, and frankly, I was a bit surprised by the quality. And in reflecting on it a bit and sort of digging into the numbers, I think what led to that increase is not necessarily the performance of companies like Amazon or eBay that are sort of pure play e-com players, but you guys have a little retailer up there in Wisconsin named Kohl's, and I suspect that they did a spectacular job on Cyber Monday. And the reality is that the brick-and-mortar traditional retailers, the biggest single location for them today for Macy's, Kohl's, Best Buy, Dick's Sporting Goods is their online site. And they've done a much better job of figuring out how to play that game. And I suspect that what we'll see when the numbers shake out and we see reporting is I think that we're going to see that a big driver behind this is that we shifted some of the sales from Dick's in-store inventory to their online stores, for example. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, that's interesting because I often think of it as online versus brick and mortar stores, but there's hybrids. I think unicorns, people call that sort of human online interface that may be the real wave of the future.
Yeah, it was interesting. I heard in the preliminary comments that retail's changed forever. And in my head, I've coined a term Cyborg Monday. And I think that, the new idea is really this integration between brick and mortar and the internet. And, in some ways, if you think about a company like Kohl's, Kohl's has, I think they have over 1,500 stores around the country. Those are effectively warehouses. And Amazon is rapidly trying to build their capability in terms of warehouses that have close proximity to their customers so that they can do things like use drones to deliver. Well, Kohl's already has those in the form of their stores, and they have access to that inventory and are, developing and probably already have capability to ship from any of those locations to give very timely types of deliveries to consumers. So I think for me, the revelation is really just that we've kind of come full circle, and the traditional retailers have you know, had the time and have the financial resources to really build and have successful online businesses.
Whether we're talking about Amazon or eBay or Walmart or Kohl's and their online incarnations, are we as a shopping culture just getting more comfortable with buying our stuff online?
Oh, I would have to say all the evidence says yes. You know, the number of people that are shopping, the mechanisms that they're using for purchasing online. If you look at, I think most of the data from over the weekend indicates that, you know, the increases in the use of tablets to make purchases was up substantially, and that smartphones were involved in a number of purchases, still aren't maybe the primary mechanism for pushing the button, if you will. But absolutely, you know, and a big part of that is, you know, the legacy, the reason Cyber Monday was invented in the first place is because the reality was, you know, when I was several years ago in business, was that we had T1 connections at our office, and at home I had a 128-bit modem. And, you know, it was just a lot easier to shop from my, my workspace. And I'm sure nobody does that today, you know, it's not as necessary because we have high-speed connectivity at home. And so, you know, ubiquitous connectivity, Wi-Fi, it's just a lot easier to utilize online shopping. And the retailers have gotten better at developing digital interfaces that are very friendly and easy for us to use. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see this trend continue.
But is there an upward level? Is there always going to be a percentage of consumers who want to be there physically in the store and be able to look at and maybe touch or try on the product before they buy it?
Certainly. I don't know if you guys have heard a term called showrooming. That was the phenomena of people going into Best Buy, looking at the items they had, and then going to Amazon and actually making the purchase. And what's happening today is, I think, you know, the brick and mortar retailers have realized that they need to embrace that concept. And there are certain people that really need to touch and feel and look at the good. There's an interesting new retailer called Bonobos that's a menswear retailer that started as an online store. And now what they have is what they call, I think it's style shops. And they don't actually have any inventory in the store. They just have, you know, one of everything. And you can go in and try things on and get to touch and feel the goods, see what fits you. But then the delivery actually comes from their website. And so this integration, to me, is really what's the most interesting thing going on right now.
So we've seen what happened on Black Friday and the weekend around it, and now Cyber Monday. How much of a percentage is that roughly of overall holiday shopping? How much is still yet to come?
Yeah, I was looking at some numbers from the National Retail Federation, and it looks like, you know, as much as 40 or 45, maybe 50% of the shopping has taken place. And I also saw data from MasterCard, I believe, that said that the first two stores that a consumer hits is where 70% of their spend goes. So, you know, this is definitely an important time, and the remainder of the holiday season is we're unlikely to see days of similar magnitudes, unless it's that last Saturday before Christmas. That always is a big shopping day.
I've seen some reporting that since the doorbusters weren't as gangbusters as retailers were hoping, that we may see a lot more big deals, maybe deeper price cuts over the next couple of weeks. Do you see that coming?
I've said this a couple of times, but I think that this is a, you know, it's who's going to blink first. Is it the consumers or the retailers? And so if the sales that they have projected, they're underperforming to that at a significant level, then it's terribly important for retailers to end this period on plan from an inventory perspective. If you look at the month of December, for most retailers, it might be four or five times the revenue volume of the month of January that follows. And so, you know, you've got to move that inventory while the customers are out there spending their money. So, the retailers are really good at tracking what's going on right now. They have good data, and if they're not meeting the expectations they have in terms of you know, moving goods out the door or into the shipping boxes, if you will, then I would suspect that we will see, you know, deep discounting to get to the levels that they need to be by the end of December.
We're talking with retail expert John Talbot about the changing face of retail. Now you can tell us what you're doing at 800-642-1234. Did you do any shopping over the weekend or on Cyber Monday? What determines who gets your business, online, big box store, or buying at a local store? And what do you think of the idea of delivering stuff by drone? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking with retail expert John Talbot of Indiana University about the changing face of retail. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you shop? Were you out shopping on the big holiday weekend? Do you like to shop online, or does it turn you off for some reason? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to the phones now. We have Eric with us in Milwaukee. Eric, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I have a bit of an issue with online shopping, mostly because I work at my arcade for redemption prizes, and when I'm working, I like using places like eBay and Amazon. But when I'm doing my own personal shopping, I just get upset that a lot of these online shops have terms of use that a lot of online services are doing right now, where if there's any legal issues going on, you're not allowed to sue in court. And I get very protective about the idea that my credit card could possibly be leaked and there'd be nothing that I could possibly do about it. That in when I go shopping at my local stores, I usually like to just have them order stuff in for me. I mean, I can just get it right there.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Eric. So, John, a couple issues there. One consumer concern, and I've heard a lot of other people complain about those terms of use or terms of service, long documents. Most of us just click OK and move along without reading them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I'm not going to lie. I don't read those either. I think that, you know, in terms of one thing that I think I could assure Eric about is that there's a firewall separation between his credit card data and any other information that they're gathering. There's very rigid rules around how retailers are able to structure their payment pages, and they don't merge that information with other data that they have related to his shopping behavior on browsers and other things like that. There's always been a firewall. Basically, that data is passed cleanly to Visa or these other payment companies. And, you know, the security is pretty good in terms of that. In terms of what they say, I mean, a lot of that just has to do with trying to absolve themselves of liability and create a mechanism where they have some legal fallback in the event that something should go wrong. I can't say personally that I've had a bad experience, and I haven't read I don't know of any a large number of cases where there's been issues related to those terms, other than that people just sometimes don't like them and it makes them nervous and therefore they don't want to shop. I think the second part I heard Eric say was just security, you know, about his card with the stores locally. Was that correct?
He was concerned about security online and locally, yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, I think that I've probably taken more risk putting my credit card in my wallet and carrying it with me to the store than I do in terms of transacting online. I think if you're transacting with a legitimate retailer, and again, back to our discussion of these, you know, brick-and-mortar stores and you know, having now online components of their business, so companies like Kohl's certainly have as many or more mechanisms for securing information on their website as they do when you go to the store themselves. The danger when you go to the store is that you lose your wallet. Somebody is watching as you make your transaction and somehow gets your number that way. I don't know that there's, you know, really factually more risk by shopping on legitimate websites than there would be with carrying around a piece of plastic that can be lost or otherwise taken by someone.
Well, I mentioned earlier, we heard news this weekend that Amazon is working on the idea of delivery by drone, speeding up their delivery process by bringing you those products with a drone. They're hoping to do it in the next couple of years. Dan from Menominee is on the line. He has some thoughts on that. Dan, hi.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, you know, I think it's almost a technological impossibility. We have been experimenting with delivery by drones here in the States for a few years, but China's been experimenting for quite a few extra. And they don't have the battery capacity to go beyond a couple of miles. I'm sure that, you know, they'll be able to eventually expand to like a metro area. So if you happen to have an Amazon warehouse in your town, it might work. But this was almost certainly a publicity stunt that Amazon pulled to get users talking about them between Black Friday and Cyber Monday. And, you know, 60 Minutes ran a piece on it. And, you know, they did a great job of having a 13-minute commercial for Amazon.
All right, Dan, thanks for the call. John, I won't put you on the hook for the finer points of drone technology, but Amazon did get a lot of publicity out of this announcement.
I think Dan is a shrewd marketer. You know, I think he's hit the nail on the head. Certainly the timing of this was not a mistake. And I might disagree. You know, it's difficult to sort of take a straight line projection and think about where technology is heading. I imagine that at some point in the future, it's conceivable. And I agree with Dan's statement that warehouse proximity is very important, but certainly we're going to continue to see improvement in battery technologies. And that's driven by a lot of different needs, not just for this particular drone, that would probably allow for, you know, a little bit longer flight times and things like that. But, you know, to make that sort of thing work, it has to be, it really is about having warehouse proximity. And Amazon is actively working on that. But I completely agree with Dan. I don't think this is something that we're going to see in the next 2 years, except as a small experiment. And I think he's right that the timing certainly didn't hurt in terms of bringing attention to Amazon at arguably the most important time of year for them.
With or without drones, Amazon has been a disruptor in the retail industry, and I assume will continue to be. You mentioned the warehouse expansion. We're seeing some of that in Wisconsin. Is Amazon going to continue to drive the retail agenda as they have been?
Oh, I have great respect for Jeff Bezos, and, you know, being an educator down here at IU, I've used examples of a lot of what he's had to say in terms of taking care of customers and other things. And I think I wouldn't underestimate the capabilities of that company. I think, you know, you just need to start thinking about who the next targets are. I mean, if they move a lot of their money in terms of where they spend dollars is really with UPS. And if, you know, if I were Mr. Bezos, which of course I'm not and never will be, I might be thinking about ways to not pay so much to UPS and really be responsible for my own deliveries to consumers. And I think that's the drones are the you know, the tip of the iceberg of that. But why wouldn't Amazon own their own trucks and things like that? They're delivering enough packages to make that a possibility, and you bring that margin inside the company and work on being more of a, they really are already a wonderful logistics company, and perhaps one part of that is actually, you know, having some capability in terms of delivery. I also think the recent partnership with the post office for Sunday delivery is interesting in light of what we see with the taxation issues around e-commerce. And I think, again, that's a smart play from a political standpoint, from Amazon's perspective, to, you know, kind of shift some political capital into their court, perhaps.
There has been some backlash on labor issues for Amazon. Some people have been complaining about conditions at the warehouses, we mentioned. Also seeing protests at Walmart, some workers saying the wages are too low. In this very intense competition, are workers facing troubles in this retail industry?
Well, the retail industry in general, particularly, you know, at the front lines of the store, has never been noted for, you know, exorbitant wages. I think some of the best retailers in the world, in the United States in particular, that probably are not as widely known, you know, do a great job of taking care of their frontline employees. You know, stores like Costco, you know, pay their store managers very, very well. And they realize that the people they have are the heart and soul of their companies. I think it's when you look at low wages for employees at retailers, I think that's one of those times where you just have to take the finger and point it right back at our own chest. And you know, why were people shopping over this weekend? They value low prices and great values. And in order for that to happen, you know, that requires very efficient mechanisms for delivery, and payroll's a big expense for these companies. And so in some ways, by us pushing for lower and lower prices, we're compelling these firms to do what they can to control wages. And you know, sometimes we have just ourselves to blame.
And John, I'll put you at the spot. Were you queuing up outside a store early Friday morning waiting for a doorbuster deal?
I was not, but I will tell you one, if you have time, a quick interesting story. I was curious about the really early openings on Thursdays this year. So I woke up really early on Thanksgiving for no particular reason, and just out of professional curiosity, drove up to my local Kmart store, which opened at 6 a.m. And the parking lot was empty. I walked inside, and there were four employees all standing around the customer service stand. And I asked them, I said, "Do you guys have any coffee?" And they said, "What?" "Well, we have cans of it." And I said, "No, I figured if you're open this early, you know, you should have some cups of coffee." They go, "No, we don't." I go, "Did your manager buy you any coffee?" "No, we didn't have any coffee, but I drank some at home before I got here." So I left and went to my local Starbucks and bought one of those great, which Starbucks is always open on Thanksgiving. Everybody was quite friendly because they'd had all the coffee they need. Bought one of those great big boxes of coffee that you get with all the fixings, and took it back and gave it to the Kmart employees and said, "That's what your boss should have done." So, you know, my heart goes out to the folks that are working so hard for all of us during this time period. And, you know, I think we should, you know, if we want them to earn more, then we got to be willing to pay more.
John, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Okay. Sure thing.
That's Bye. John Talbot, Associate Director of the Center for Education and Research in Retailing at Indiana University.
Genetic testing is becoming more and more prevalent and leading some people to live in medical limbo.
Sometimes people test positive for a potentially life-threatening disease, but they aren't showing any symptoms. They're being called patients in waiting.
Here to talk about some of these genetic testing practices and how they're changing family life is Rachel Grob. She's the Director of National Initiatives and Scholar in Residence at the Center for Patient Partnerships at UW-Madison. She's also the author of Testing Baby, the Transformation of Newborn Screening, Parenting, and Policymaking. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
So define for us what newborn screening is and how it's done.
Newborn screening is a population-wide screening program for infants. It's done by extracting a few drops of blood from the heel of a newborn while still in the hospital, or for that small minority of babies born at home, midwives do the procedure at home. Parents will perhaps recall seeing a Band-Aid on their baby's foot or being present when the procedure is done. And the screening test began long ago just for one or two conditions, and in the past decade or so has expanded so that we're testing for many more conditions than was originally the case.
Are all newborns automatically screened, or is it something that parents must opt in for?
They are automatically screened. Many states have an opt-out provision, often only for religious reasons, which is the case in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But it is not a program for which consent is actively sought from parents, except for in one or two states. In Wisconsin, your baby will be tested unless you explicitly object for religious purposes ahead of time.
Really? And so then the results of the test are automatically given, or only in cases where something has been found?
Generally, parents are unlikely to hear from their pediatrician about the results of the screening unless there is an issue and they are called for follow-up testing. Recall that this is a screening program, so it doesn't by itself usually result in a diagnosis. It's sort of the first step along a pathway to figure out if there is indeed something wrong with the baby.
Do these tests have false positives?
They do, and this is a troubling part of the program. It has a very high rate of false positives, and so in all likelihood, if you receive a positive or abnormal newborn screen for your baby, it is likely to be ruled a false positive. They are increasingly trying to adjust the technology so that the rate of false positives goes down, but it remains to this day quite high. And when new conditions are added to the panel, which has happened at a rapid rate recently, the false positive rate is generally very, very high for those new conditions.
Wow. So talk a little bit about how they go about figuring out that it is indeed a false positive.
So they'll do follow-up testing for the condition in question, and it depends what the condition is, what form that testing will take. And they will either find that there was some issue with the blood spot if it was collected when the infant was too young, like before 24 hours old. There can often be problems with the blood spot, or it can just be some abnormality or artifact of the laboratory process. That's sort of one category. That's a true false positive, as it were. Then picking up on the introduction that you just gave to this issue of patients in waiting or people in this medical limbo, there are procedures that may result in the finding that there's a variant, a genetic variant of unknown significance. This means that our medical science does not yet understand what this kind of genetic variant means. There can be a diagnosis of a condition such as cystic fibrosis, for example, which is a very complex condition. And just because the diagnostic criteria through the follow-up testing after newborn screening result in the assigning of the name cystic fibrosis, the disease label, to the child, that does not necessarily mean that that child will become symptomatic, because there's a very broad spectrum of how that condition and a number of other conditions we screen for are expressed by newborn screening. And, you know, an interesting point related to that is that logically, this makes sense, right? Because what newborn screening does is it screens the entire healthy population, not a subpopulation that's been determined to be at risk, and not a population that's already symptomatic, trying to figure out if there is indeed a genetic condition that could be responsible for the emergence of symptoms. Those are the ways that traditionally genetic testing was most commonly used. Now that we are screening newborns for a lot of conditions, we're looking at the entire healthy population and we're finding genetic variation, but we don't always know what the relationship is between those abnormalities that are detected on the newborn screen and through some follow-up testing and what the health outcome or manifestation of that condition will or will not be in a particular child.
So let's say my baby has tested positive for having the gene that could lead to some sort of major disease or disorder. What decision am I left to make at that point when I'm only armed with the knowledge?
Right. At the point of receiving the abnormal newborn screen.
Right.
So you will do follow-up testing, and depending on the condition, the degree of uncertainty will vary. For some conditions, there's a more clear diagnostic pathway, and with other conditions, there's much greater variation and therefore greater uncertainty. But you will undergo follow-up testing. You will become involved with specialists who have expert knowledge regarding that condition, and perhaps you will have a true positive diagnosis with a clear pathway that includes treatment that can prevent severe disability, illness, or even death in your infant. That's why the newborn screening program was created, to identify those early onset and treatable conditions. And many families benefit tremendously from newborn screening's capacity to do that. With the expanded panel and the additional knowledge that's being generated, the information that's being generated through the testing and the knowledge of the natural history of these diseases that has not yet caught up, you may also be in the category of a medical limbo where your child has been confirmed as having a genetic variant of some kind or even of a condition, but it's unclear what that means. In some cases, there will be some prophylactic or preventative treatment that you'll be advised to engage in for your child. And in other cases, it will be sort of watchful waiting and monitoring and visits to a clinic.
Mm-hmm. Well, newborn screening is a fairly new technology, as we've been discussing, and it's continuing to evolve rapidly. How is it going to continue to evolve, and how will it change parents' experience?
That's a good question. We've just seen a rapid expansion of newborn screening with the advent of a technology called tandem mass spectrometry, or MSMS, which is now being used across the country, which allowed for the testing of approximately 50 conditions with one blood spot going through this tandem mass spectrometer. And that was a big change, because it used to be that you'd have a separate procedure or assay for each condition you had to test for. So that ability to test for multiple conditions with one technology really changed the screening program and made it inexpensive and sort of easily accessible to do that kind of testing, although there's ongoing controversy over what conditions we should and shouldn't screen for, and whether that criteria that newborn screening originally started out with of early onset treatable conditions that were acceptable to the community, it still applies, right? Because that's been loosened up and we're now testing for things that are not necessarily early onset and where treatability is somewhat more debated.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to have the capacity with new technologies to identify even more conditions and variants with whole genome sequencing, and there's already debate about the application of that technology in newborn screening.
Well, that's something to look out for. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thank you.
It was Rachel Grob of the UW-Madison. She's the author of Testing Baby, The Transformation of Newborn Screening, Parenting, and Policymaking.